still waiting for somebody, are we? Gavin, yeah. So we're on page 4 in our booklet. Page 4. An old record. Which was written before I'm first hearing a cuckoo. It was written before Webb was 20 years old. We don't know exactly the date he wrote it, but he was born in 1925 and this was written sometime between 43 and 45. So he wrote this before he was 20. And it was when he was 15 or 16 that he came home one day at North Sydney and found his grandfather dead on the floor. And he had to cope with that. That was a real shock for him because his grandfather was like a surrogate father for him. So this was in the wake of that event. And this old record is his quest for reconnection, for coherence. But I think what I'm trying to build up is this sense that all his poetry has in it this deep quest for the tender voyaging line of truth. And it's in this poem, in the third stanza, that he refers to the word beauty. I'll just read this third stanza here. This jaded earth props and staggers. Jaded earth. Again, this was written, you know, either at the end or immediately afterward or just before the end of the Second World War. This jaded earth props and staggers. So it's not only his own personal history, but global history that, you know, he as a young poet is trying to make sense of. Give me meaning for spur, or a call from the garbled scrub of the night. The garbled scrub of the night. His own consciousness, the condition of the world. Beauty, I tell you, seems almost past sustaining. Baffled by maniac hands that bluff the light. So few, like Roland at the crumbling world, at the crumbling wall, circling God knows what perils, will wind out a rusted note of challenge and jauntily wait for an echo, so much as a simple flint to fall. And this is a direct reference to Roland, the Charlemagne hero who went in quest of this location where he was going to find a resolution to conflict. And Robert Browning's poem, which I will give you a copy of next time, I actually had it ready today but forgot to bring it. Robert Browning's poem is a poem about someone going through a nightmarish landscape, having been directed to go into that nightmarish landscape and feeling afraid at the start but saying I'm going to do it anyway, and going through and eventually finding what he looks for, not sure whether he's reached there, and blowing a note of challenge on a trumpet. A rusted note of challenge. So, and it's in the bottom right-hand corner there, it's in Shakespeare's King Lear that the trigger for Robert Browning's poem came in this quote from Edgar in Act 3, Scene 4. Child Roland to the dark tower came. His word was still, "Fifo and fum, I smell the blood of a British man." Now, if you know King Lear, then this moment in the play is just before Edgar and Lear and the fool enter the hovel on the heath in the middle of the storm. And it's a time of metanoia. It's a time where King Lear comes to recognize the extent of his own idiocy and strips himself off in the storm and bears himself to the storm and says, "I have taken too little consciousness of what other people need." So, you know, there is an interesting link here. I mean, Frank Webb was very versed in Shakespeare as well as in other poets. We could explore that later. But the poem for me that always sings out this affirmation of the power and the value of art, poetry, music, visual arts, is this poem by Shakespeare, Shakespeare Sonnet 65, which is a poem not only about the inevitable transience of everything in the universe, the eventual decomposition of the earth itself, since brass nor stone nor earth nor boundless sea but sad mortality o'ersways their power. But it's also, in the middle of the poem, it's got lots of references to human destructiveness, the wreckful siege of battering days, the imagery from medieval warfare. So it's a poem about the impulse in humanity and in the cosmos for dissolution. And against that, there is beauty. And what is beauty? Well, beauty is conveyed in the metaphor of a flower. How with this rage shall beauty hold a plea whose action is no stronger than a flower? This is Shakespeare's deepest question, I feel, about his life's work as a poet, as a dramatist. How with this rage, the rage of destructive time and destructiveness in human affairs, how? What strong hand can hold time's swift foot back? Who his spoil of beauty can forbid? It's interesting that he uses the flower is the most delicate, the most vulnerable of all things. And yet, in this last two lines, he affirms the power of the creative word. And you can take it on a very simple literal level, if you like. Here is a poem that was written nearly 500 years ago, or 500 years ago, and it's still here in black ink. Oh, none unless this miracle have might, that in black ink my love may still shine bright. So when Webb talks about beauty, I tell you, seems almost past sustaining. So let's listen to the Caruso record briefly. And this is not the Caruso record, this is just a Caruso record that I happen to get my hands on. That's all right, we've got it up here somewhere.
The cover of the record, Michael, is that the original
That's
cover?
not the original, sorry.
Thank you.
So you get the picture. That is what, that's what the poem is responding to, an old record. So let's read the poem as a whole. And I'll make a few comments along the way, if you don't mind. The books have devised a setting fit for us. So the location where this poem is taking place, the writing of it is taking place. Some documented stage convention claims its candle. A tangle of shadows laid thus and thus, stapled with tricks of colour, as in our vague dreams. The metronome, like that inquiring clock, niched in a heart's great tower, as I might say, allotting its due of panic to each day. Huge traffic of life and death, the lapse and shock of derelict thought, event. So he's describing this setting where the poem takes place. He's listening to this old record that he has from his father's collection, and we get some sense of the environment in which he's listening to it and where this poem begins to take shape in his mind. He's also describing his own internal state of mind and also maybe the state of mind of the singer. It's due of panic, huge traffic of life and death, the lapse and shock of derelict thought. Then in the next part of this stanza, after this break, he begins, and on fresh tack. There's a shift in the metaphor here. He suddenly kind of turns his way of looking at this event to someone who is searching through the ocean. And on fresh tack, I thread spent hulls, reefs of the future and danger, pirate of peace to a port of drift and slack. I ring you with mountain minutes, dead silver singer. I ring you with mountain, I'm encircling you with mountain minutes. I'm a pirate of peace. I'm threading hulls, reefs, danger. I'm looking for a port of drift and slack. Very similar kind of orientation as you have in first hearing a cuckoo. And here it's not a cuckoo, but it's the dead silver singer. He's wanting to hear something of the truth coming through this sound. For properties, I am the shadow and glimmer. For properties, you know, you think of a stage set or a film set, that it's got its props. So he's kind of setting up this mini drama of him being in search of the essence or the truth of this old record. He's setting it up now like a stage effect. But we've already seen that it's a stage effect that's somehow built on the ocean. And actually, his beautiful poem, For My Grandfather, which we haven't got here, but it's worth looking at, his grandfather, who was a ferry master in on the Sydney Harbour, he, after his grandfather's death, he writes a poem praising his grandfather, but where he looks for his grandfather's spirit is at the bottom of Sydney Harbour. So the harbour really kind of beckons Webb with a kind of an unknown, investigable place where something could possibly be found. And those of you that know Kenneth Slessor, who know Five Bells, that poem is very much a similar kind of search for what can you see in the harbour for someone who's passed over to the other side. For properties, I am the shadow and glimmer. My clean poised thought, like an otter, will strike after some warped glint in the depths, a silver tremor, still careless if all it finds be a stone in the water. In this powdering light, on the shaken yellow beach, I finger a salvage shred, bleached waxen shell. That's why I've got the shell up in the image on the left there. I'm very literal minded. I finger a salvage shred, bleached waxen shell, still shivering with fugitive passion of a bell. He puts the shell up to his ear and tries to hear the sound of the ship's bell. Epic of drama and storm, passed out of reach. Yet death, hungry for fragments, switches back a long tentacle from that storm. The bell swept out so far is quarry for the throttling wind. So your fading song swings out in cadence like a falling star. So that's the Caruso song. He's hearing through the song. He's hearing the cadence swinging out like a falling star. Now, something has to be said about the star. When I was, I didn't mention it before, but Rose and I, we visited Frank Webb's sisters on a number of occasions. And she spoke about the fact that when the children had been taken up by the grandparents said, "Your mother and your father are in the sky, they're in the stars." And there is, you know, there's a real sense in which the stars for Webb was a kind of a connection with his mother and his father. Next stanza, which we've already looked at, after the "like a falling star." "This jaded earth props and staggers. Give me meaning for spur, or a call from the garbled scrub of the night. Beauty, I tell you, seems almost past sustaining. Baffled by maniac hands that bluff the light, so few like Roland at the crumbling wall, circling God knows what perils." This idea of circling God, we've had "ring you with mountain minutes." Those of you that are going to do the Rilke course with me in November, this is a very Rilkean idea. Rilke often has images of circling to try and find God in a circle. "Circling God knows what perils will wind out a rusted note of challenge and jauntily wait for an echo, so much as a simple flint to fall." And now that leitmotif is a term, for musical term, from in symphonies, in operas, a repeated phrase is a leitmotif, and a leitmotif could be in poetry, the mention again of the two words of the cuckoo, that's a leitmotif in that poem. And now that leitmotif, that last note, curls out to the throng ditches and valor fills the sky. Hear how that whippet oboe snarls, a yellow streak of defiance at the crowding hills. Okay, just turn to your neighbour for a moment. Who is my neighbour? You two are neighbours, 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 Margaret and Rose, neighbours, neighbours, and neighbours. Turn to your neighbour for a moment and express for you what is the most important moment in this poem. What for you was the most important moment in this poem? Thank you. Okay. Can we share a few thoughts you might have had? Please go stand. Speak into it.
I thought.
No, it's not on. It's not on. Push up. Try that. A bit closer.
Yes, I thought the whole thing's tied to the record, isn't it?
It is, yes.
And to the music.
And to the music, yes.
And the round and round is a record on the table.
That's very good. Yep, yep. So that's certainly one way of interpreting this idea of circling and round, that's right. But that becomes a metaphor for something wider than that too, doesn't it? So it's not just the record going around, but it's Webb going around with the record and then going around to look for something that's somewhere in the centre. That's very good. Anything else you want to say, Stan, while you've got the floor?
I did think that the Whippet Oboe,
yes,
is a giveaway to the fact that this has to be tied to the performance on the record.
Performance on record, that's right. And as I was playing the record here, I didn't choose a very good one because this was piano accompaniment rather than orchestral accompaniment. So the actual record that he used would have had Caruso with a orchestral accompaniment and an oboe. I couldn't find it. Don't know which one it is. That's good. Yep. Someone else like to make a comment? Yes, Mari.
Just picking up on that, the part that spoke to me was,
yep,
Certainly God knows what perils will wind out a rusted note of chant and broadly wait for an echo.
Yes.
And it seems to me that he's listening to the record for the identity of his grandfather.
Father.
And in a sense, it's captured in that record. It's there's a flint of it there to fall. And then as the record builds up at the end, the last note curls out the throng ditches of doubt. So he snatches the lover of his father at the end.
Yes, beautiful, beautiful. And also, just when you mentioned the word flint, immediately you think of spark.
Yes.
So there's that possible connotation as well. Beautiful. Yes, Ambrose.
I picked the line in the third
stanza.
Beauty, I tell you, seems almost past sustained.
Yeah, good. That's a great line.
And that's sort of for me, I suppose it appeals to that more sort of philosophic,
yes,
position on, going back to the circle, I think in a way the circle, of course, is a symbol of infinity.
Yep.
And not necessarily in this case presented like a positive thing, but
yep,
it's the infiniteness of rephrasing the question constantly about, again, what actually is beauty in that sense.
Yes.
And
yes,
so these things are open to interpretation.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. Beauty seems almost past sustaining. Yep. Yeah. Good. Gavin, please.
I just wanted to comment on the line, for properties I am the shadow and general line, clean poised, thought like a butter was struck after some warmth turned to the depths.
Yes.
I thought it was amazingly beautiful.
It is.
And then similar to the cuckoo poem, he uses a lot of images of blurriness and obscurity. So
yep,
they are shadow and glimmer. Then there's this moment of absolute clarity with the thought, which then ends in disappointment. So if it finds a stone in the water.
Yeah.
So the whole poem is about just reaching out for something that isn't there.
Yes.
I don't know what that is. It could be God, because that's the theme in the the jaded earth stands there as well.
Yes.
Calling for nothing, I suppose, or potentially nothing.
Well, yeah, it's really interesting what you're asking. What is he calling for? And is it all contained in that word beauty? Is beauty the essence of what he's looking for? And then what does beauty mean? Does it mean connection with the ineffable, connection with his father, connection with the truth of the... I mean, the record itself, this garbled, rough record, is such a powerful metaphor for something that is being occluded and yet is somehow there, reaching through to it. Yes, did you want to add something, Gerard? Microphone. Please.
Coming back to,
not on. Push it up. That's it. Try now.
Going back.
No, not there yet.
There we are. Going back to circling on the record.
Yep.
You go from the outer to the inner. So
yes.
Into the inner self.
Yes. That's it. Beautiful. You go from the outer gradually inward. Yeah, that's it. Lovely expansion of that metaphor. Beautiful. Okay, so what we're going to do now, we're going to move on. Yes, please, Michael. Yep. Go, yep. Back.
You mentioned in passing last week that Francis Webb had gone with the Air Force to Canada.
Yes.
As indeed my father did.
Oh, wow.
And he was training to be a rear gunner, tail gunner.
He was, yeah. Webb was.
Webb was, yes.
Yep.
So was my father.
Really? Wow.
It's almost a death sentence.
Yeah. Yeah. What year was your father doing that?
That went over in 42.
Well, Webb was about 5 years later.
Yeah, that came back. He refused to pick it up.
Right.
He went to Canada and his training came up.
Yeah, yeah.
Not long married and had a baby that he did not see.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering...
That was you.
No, it wasn't. I was there at three before.
All right.
I'm just wondering what effect... Generally, the environment of war, a sensitive man like this, for you and the machine gun to fire, knowing what it was going to do, the prospect, they knew, but then especially, they knew what a tail gunner's lot was.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there any evidence that that affected his poetry? I thought I was seeing intimations of it there.
Well, it could well be intimations of it there, you know, in all the references to the condition of the world, the jaded earth props and staggers. I mean, all that must play into his overall sensitivity to what's happening in the world environment. He does write a couple of poems specifically about his war experience, and we don't have them in here. And they talk. One of them's about the tail gunner, but he didn't see action as such, so you know, he didn't have the full horror of it.
One of the reasons it was almost a death sentence is because they couldn't wear a parachute.
You're right.
The space inside the tail where the gunner lay was too small.
You're right.
So the plane was shot down.
Wow. Okay. Yes, please. Peter.
As much as Webb as a sensitive poet, but
yes.
In the poem The Runner.
The Runner, yes.
He equally understands that will to
win.
And it's a ruthless one. So there's an aspect of Webb that celebrates also winning and battle. So it's not a...
sensitive wild wallflower.
Yeah, not always. There's that side to
In
his writing.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you for that. Okay, I want to move on to... this poem here. Now it's on the sheet that I handed out to you, the extra sheet, which actually contains the poem that you do have in your booklet. You have in your booklet, this is on page 18, you have two of the poems from In Memoriam Anthony Sands, 1806 to 1883. Anthony Sands was a painter from the Norwich School, and this portrait of his hung in the Strangers' Hall. And when I was writing the book on Francis Webb, Rose and I actually visited with our children Norwich, and we visited Strangers Hall, and we saw this painting, and we saw a number of other works there at that time. This is going back to 1990, so it's almost a lifetime ago when our kids were about 86 it was, right, so it's 30 years ago, okay. So the poem we're going to look at is the one that contains the line, tender voyaging line of truth, and the poem is called Self-Portrait, and it mentions Strangers Hall. And to be honest, I'm not 100% sure whether this self-portrait is the actual self-portrait that he's referring to, or whether Anthony Sands had any other self-portraits. Because there's one detail of this that doesn't quite fit this image. Anthony Sands was a well-known artist in the Norwich School. His son, Frederick Sandys, became internationally famous as one of the Pre-Raphaelite artists. So that's Frederick Anthony Sands. If you look it up on Google, you'll find Frederick Anthony Sands is the son of this Anthony Sands. And these poems, In Memoriam Anthony Sands, well, they're part of a larger series called Around Cossey. And Cossey is the village in which the mental hospital that Webb was in, Hellesden Hospital, Cossey was the village in which that mental hospital existed. And there was one Catholic church in Cossey which he used to walk to on Sundays from the mental hospital. He wasn't in a locked ward there. When we went there, I actually talked to a couple of nurses who still remembered him being there, because we were there in 86 and he'd been there in the late 50s. So it was, you know, because he came back to Australia in 1961. So it was, you know, nearly 30 or 40 years after he'd been there. You can see in the handout that I've given you, you can see at the top of the left-hand column, you can see there a reference to an earlier poem where he refers to Cossey. He says, on this Easter Monday, I will drink your Cossey to the dregs. And that's in fact what he did do. He drank Cossey to the dregs in terms of his connection with the history, the natural environment, the art. He really made a strong connection with that time that he was in England. And his response to Anthony Sands' paintings, well, here's the painting that we will come to shortly, the poem number one, Bird Song Is Your Reverberating Touch. This is the painting that he had in his room, and it was, you know, almost like a religious icon for him, because he saw the cross in the sails of the windmill, and, well, you'll see when we come to that poem how he, in a sense, evaluates his own artistic activity against that of the visual artist. We've already talked about the extent of his connection with music in Delius, in Caruso, how these became triggers for his own representation, or in tasting the quality of his own creativity. You know, he was sort of, in a way, kind of measuring himself, measuring his own capacity as a wordsmith. You know, you said earlier, Peter, how the two words sort of existed outside the dead word haunted man. The art almost exists beyond the language. And it comes back to mind what T.S. Eliot said about his own writing in the Four Quartet. Words reach into the silence. And so much of the Four Quartets is actually about the wrestle of words, and the way that words are kind of slippery and slide and will decay and not stay precise. There's a wonderful quote there we could have used. Decay with imprecision, will not stay still. T.S. Eliot, about his own writing, how poetry and art can be so much about its own incapacities and yet reaching to something ineffable beyond it. As I think all art, in a way, is. So here, self-portrait. Self-portrait, this is how he writes about self-portrait. Fullness, shadow. lean forward from the wall of Strangers' Hall. He's here talking specifically about Anthony Sands' self-portrait. And we saw this portrait, maybe not this one, I can't remember. Do you remember, Rose? You wouldn't remember. I can't remember. Lean forward from the wall of Strangers' Hall. Strangers' Hall, by the way, was built in about 1320. And it's now a museum of local history. Lean forward from the wall of Strangers' Hall, beneath languid chandelier. Strangeness, the womb of this alien, prayerful place. And the propitious pallor of your face, propitious, both favorable but pale, the propitious pallor of your face is orderly, at once wind-wise and still, as the sinewy, exquisite, living winter flower. Come back to Shakespeare's lines about beauty and the flower. Fullness, shadow. Again I am abashed amid scuttling designs of chaos at your mission to sing the posture of reality. Unsubtle, one did say chivalrous as the tree. So I'm abashed amid scuttling designs of chaos. Here we get again Webb kind of referring to his own sense of his own inner space. Amid scuttling designs of chaos, and Anthony Sands' mission, and I think he's here talking beyond simply the self-portrait, he's talking about what he knows of Anthony Sands' art, as we've seen in the previous poem, number one. Your mission to sing the posture of reality. Unsubtle. Now, there is something about Anthony Sands' paintings that are unsubtle. They're very, you know, they're kind of there. There's nothing sort of mysterious or... One did say chivalrous as the tree. So we can think about what is meant there about his understanding of this particular artist. An outline of fullness, soberly embraced by shadow of widest meaning, is creation. Interesting two lines that can almost describe Webb's own artistry. Outline of fullness, soberly embraced by shadow of widest meaning, is creation. And here we come to the key line that Herbert Read senses is the core of Webb's poetry. Fullness, shadow. What to tell again but the so tender voyaging line of truth? Time shuffles a timid foot, will linger while the tired cock crow of your lifted finger opens dawn and a worn album of love and pain. Brown eyes and hair flow humbly from the earth. I'll just give you one minute to think about what might be meant by an outline of fullness soberly embraced by shadow of widest meaning. And those two lines seem to kind of pick up this refrain: fullness, shadow, fullness, shadow, fullness, shadow. In a way, this poem almost needs poem one, but we won't go there yet. Let's see what you glean from just this poem. Anybody have a thought? Then please speak it straight away. Microphone.
Ah, yes.
Where is it? Is it in front of you?
Just always loved that term soberly, as in rather than maybe a lot of modernist expressionist art was about getting drunk and carried away, but he refers to it as a sober, which is like being steady.
Yep.
And
yeah, I reckon that's pretty grand. It's very classical.
Yeah.
I showed him some paintings one time I'd done. They were very expressionist, Satine-style portraits. And he said to me, what about trying a lovely classical face for order?
Yeah. Interesting comment when he sort of reacted so negatively to Norman Lindsay's demands that he not be obscure, yeah, and that he, you know, he be more direct and classical in his. So it's interesting.
He liked that idea, yeah, of sober classicism.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, the paintings that he collected as well, the sorts of paintings that he was interested in, you know, they were historical, classical.
Well, they got more romantic.
You're romantic.
Sense.
Yeah.
With their atmosphere.
Yeah, definitely. Ambrose.
English art at the time was actually caught up with looking back.
Yes.
Looking retrospectively to classicism.
Yes.
The Victorian era basically is totally submerged in that.
Yep.
And, the romanticism, there was the romantic thing happening on the continent mainly.
Yep.
It sort of seeped into the British Isles, I suppose, but then also one of the big things that was happening in Paris, for instance, and in Europe generally, was a need to understand realism, reality.
Yeah.
So that came up in philosophical discussions as much as in visual arts. So the way we think of Courbet, for instance, and then we look at Manet, how he took that and stepped it into where the reality wasn't as much the subject, but yeah, it was the language in which it was painted. So language started, it's beginning of modernism, really.
Are you talking about impressionism there when you talk about the language?
Yes. Yeah. So this is preceding impressionism, yeah, and leads to it.
Yeah.
Where language itself, and this is, I suppose, something we are still aware of, language itself, in the broadest sense, by the way, visual, etc.,
yeah,
is what the subject is.
The language is what the subject is. Yeah.
That's the subject.
Beautiful, beautiful. Okay, that's lovely. Now I want to, on that note, I want to read the first poem, and then we have to finish the first poem, which is about language. And it's actually about the language of poetry and the language of art. And this is where we'll come back to next week. And we'll come back to this poem, and we'll come back to the third poem called Death, which is in your book. And we'll move on to Edward John Eyre, and we'll move on to Ward 2 and Wild Honey, and then we'll come back to St. Francis and the Leper. We will do that. I was thinking we'd do that today, but it seemed to me to be, in a sense, it's almost the most difficult poem. And if we can come back to that from the point of view of his search for the so tender voyaging line of truth, his quest through St. Francis for an understanding of the leper. So here is this poem about language, which is a direct reference to this painting here. So take a snapshot of that painting and keep it in your mind's eyes. Actually, I'll put this up on the blog this week. I don't know if any of you saw my blog last week, which had the recording of this, of these. I don't know to what extent I'm breaching copyright by having Ambrose and Peter and Jared and other people's voices up there for all the world to listen to. You come and get me to sign a whatever if you like. Here we go. In Memoriam, Anthony Sands. Birdsong is your reverberating touch. That's the art. That's the art. That's Anthony Sands' art. The line of truth. But metaphor is the enormous second frozen, his language, reduced behind courtly glass and laid in stores out of the public view for certain years. He had notebooks full of scribbles that he didn't put down into poems yet. Let my ungainly icicle pencil search down below zero. You are temperate, risen. Here he's actually writing about the art of Anthony Sands. December's bird again. He's always got birds in his poems. Blackbird, maybe. What shall I say? Your canny brushstroke, canny brushstroke, Anthony Sands' brushstroke, and beatitude, and hallowed second, hallowed, consecrated, honoured as holy. Your canny brushstroke and beatitude and hallowed second, bravely out of fashion, because this, you know, this was not fashionable art even then, bravely out of fashion, leap beyond Hydra. They leap beyond the many-headed snake, beyond the last constellation, in eternal motion. That's how he sees Anthony Sands' art. What's it reaching to? My gropings broaden into hour and day, awaiting the wash of your great altitude. So he's kind of getting down in his knees almost in front of what he sees as the power of this artist. Past luring the bird, so he can't find the bird to speak of. But if in my side room, that's in his room in Hellesden Hospital in Kosi, I taste the Broads once more, and that's the Broads, what you're seeing on the screen there. That's the Broads of Norfolk Broads, these sheets of water all around Norfolk. I taste the Broads once more and genuflect before the mill and daring dated cross. There's the mill, there's the daring dated cross. Swim in golds westerly and auras. There is the gold, the westerly gold of the setting sun. Swim in golds westerly and auras, pass into civil distances, blues and marshalled gloom. My hungry frame, as the artist, traps light. I stand erect, mixing all colours, the December bird. I rear my glass facade of metaphor. Oh, it is my world rocks on the easel under serene, genial currents of idling thunder. Cannot sustain that feather gentle word, lies gaping on the stockpile or the floor. So here he's really, in that last stanza, he's kind of linking, almost superimposing his own artistry on the easel of the visual artist, but finds that it can't be sustained. So I'm going to leave you with that poem, and we'll move on next week, keep going. Next week we've got two sessions, Tuesday and Friday. Tuesday at 10 and then Friday at 10. And then we finish. So whatever we finish on, we'll finish with. But hopefully, well not hopefully, we will get to Ward 2. I'm so grateful that Peter's here. Thank you very much, Peter, for coming. Your insights, your experience of talking with Frank Webb is just invaluable. It's fantastic.
But his poetry, come back to again and again, and the richness, that fullness and
yeah.
Shadow and form.
That's right.
And thought.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's stunning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's great to hear that. It's great to hear that. Beautiful. Thank you all. Yeah. Any announcements, Mari? So who has to leave their chairs?
Yes, from Anne. No, from Anne around to me.
Okay, so everybody else from Kevin's around here to move your chairs up. Yeah.
Yes, from Mark.